This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Tom Dwelly. Today is 13 October 2017 and we are in beautiful San Antonio, Texas. Mr. Dwelly, to begin the interview, I'd like to get some background and biographical information from you. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
You bet, Kelly. Good afternoon. I was born in Hanford, California, August the 5th, 1937. I was 80 years old last month, still fly certainly a couple of times a week, so we're having a lot of fun out in Northern California, Auburn, Northern California, in the Air Force 24 years, but retired in the North, and life is good.
Well, that's good to hear. Congratulations on that. What are your parents' names?
My parents were Tom and Marge Dwelly, born and dead in 1911, and my mother, Marjorie, 1913. They're both gone now.
Mm-hmm. What did they do for a living?
Dad was a mechanical engineer. We're Welsh. My people came out of Wales, hard rock miners. He worked, went to Berkeley and worked in the gold mines in college up in Grass Valley, just north of Auburn, in the mother-loved country up there.
What about your mother?
Mom was a housewife. She was a nurse's aide during the war. She went to USC, Southern California. They got together and had me then in beautiful downtown Hanford, California, which is an interesting place. I don't need to go back there.
You have brothers or sisters?
I have three brothers. 3 years younger than I is Steve. He's a retired, I'm a retired lieutenant colonel, by the way. Steve is a retired full colonel. He was the Thunderbird. He was Thunderbird number 5 when they were flying F-4s, 1971 and 72. He was an aggressor squadron commander at Red Flag. Number 3 brother, Walt, graduated from Berkeley. He didn't think he wanted to kill people and break things like what Steve and I were doing. So he joined the Navy and flew the A-3 out of Rota, Spain, electronic intelligence. While Steve and I were in the war getting our butts shot off, he was flying out of Rota, Spain. Youngest brother, David, went to Cal Poly in Central California and left us on the left coast there. He was a draft dodger. Hell no, I won't go. He was headed for the for Canada, and never quite got there. He had a phony trumped up medical thing with which was irritating, but I forgave him. He says, "You know, Tommy," he says, "maybe I made a bad decision." He said, "I see you going all over the world. You've got friends everywhere. You're going to meetings in beautiful places like San Antonio and what have you." And he says, "I missed all of that. Maybe I made the bad, a wrong decision." I said, "Dave, one thing I know, if you'd have been drafted and been forced to go to Vietnam as a soldier or whatever, chances are very good I wouldn't have a little brother now, so I forgive you." So that's the end of that. We're very close. All four brothers still alive, still working closely. We've got a multi-billion dollar company now that we own personally, private energy company. We're into solar and oil and gasoline and trucks and card locks and ethanol, and we're having a lot of fun. And we're still all in great shape, so it's amazing.
It sounds like an awful lot of fun. Well, let me take you back to being a kid here. Did you grow up there in Central California, I assume?
I did.
Tell me about growing up. What was that like in the 40s?
Yep, 40s and 50s. I graduated from high school in Visalia. We're raised in Visalia, just down the Highway 198 from Sequoia National Park. Mm-hmm. Beautiful park, I went to high school there, and then one year of junior college, and we were flyers. My father was flying, right? He wanted to fly for the military. in World War II, but they would not allow him to do it. My grandfather, on my mother's side, founded the Beacon Oil Company in California. We had a refinery in Hanford, where I was born, and service stations up and down California, and we're making Avgas for the war effort. Mm. And he wanted to go and be a fighter pilot, I guess. I hope not a bomber pilot, but I don't know that. He certainly loved flying. And right after the war, he bought a BT-13, a consolidated Vultee BT-13, which was the basic trainer, fixed gear, 450 horsepower. And he had two of those. And that's what I learned to fly in. When I was in high school, we were flying all the time, everywhere. We flew down to the day after Chuck Yeager broke the sand barrier in October the 14th, I think, or 15th, 1947. Flew down to Muroc, Dry Lake, got to meet Pancho Barnes. Oh man, and I'm 10 years old And I don't remember much about that, except that she was a wiry, she was a real interesting lady. And there were a bunch of long-legged ladies jumping in and out of the motel rooms. And I thought, well, I wonder what in the hell is going on here? But I could tell everybody was having a lot of fun, and Chuck and Bob Cardenas and the guys. We're having a lot of fun at the Happy Bottom Riding Club, which was Pancho Barnes' bar and the dude ranch down there. Anyway, growing up in Visalia was very warm, and no such thing as air conditioning. It was tough, but we got through it. Hot rods were what were the name of the game, and everybody had one at best we could afford. And got started with the ladies and girlfriends, and life was good. Went from there to college in Denver, Colorado, DU, and then off to the military in July of 59. And 24 years later, I came out the other end, still alive and well, and still normal blood pressure after all those years. In July of 1982.
Huh. You mentioned that your father wanted to fly in World War II, but they wouldn't let him. Is that because of his job with producing aviation fuels?
Yeah, good, Kelly. I missed that point. Thank you. They said, Mr. Dwelly, he was Tom also. Mr. Tom Dwelly, no, you can't go. Draft board said, you cannot go. You're doing more good for the war effort right there where you are. He was a stillman at that point, running the crude unit, producing gasoline and petroleum products out of that wonderful Elk Hills crude oil over in the coast, which Jimmy Carter gave away, sold for one of his big donors. More about that later. But we're in the oil business through and through, but they would not allow him to go. So right after the war, then he bought a couple of BT-13s, and we were flying a lot. I remember a barrel of gasoline out of the refinery was $5, 10 cents a gallon, something like that. Incredible. We're putting it straight into the airplane, one of these things, or balancing it on the back tailgate of Dad's truck and gravity feeding it into the wings. And that's how we learned to fly. That was to hold me in good stead in the years later, in 1964, when I went off to Hurlburt Field, Eglinox 9 in Florida, to become acquainted with the Big Douglas A-1 Skyraider.
Mm-hmm. That must have been pretty heady days for you and your brothers learning to fly, having the opportunity to learn to fly like that.
Oh yeah. Well, it was we're flying off a little grass strip, and you just barely could do it. I mean, that BT-13 was a pretty big for us. And there was one AT-6 there, and I never saw them fly that out of our little grass strip with the California oak trees on each end. But that was the big boys. That's what the big boys were flying. lo and behold, I still own two of those today, and we're having a lot of fun with those. We do air shows, and when one of the, we live just above in the foothills, 30 miles east of Sacramento. When one of the greatest generation dies anywhere around Sacramento, I can put a four ship together with smoke in 2 hours, and we'll throw our stuff down and go and do it. And that feels good. That feels really good to do that.
Yeah.
And the boys, too. The boys fly. If I'm on a trip, then the boys will take both our airplanes and arrange for two others, and we get her done, you know.
Yeah, that's really cool. Going back to the Second World War, obviously you're going to be pretty young when this is going on, being born in 1937, but do you have any memories of the war?
I do. From Hanford, California, we moved to Bakersfield. Dad became a Beacon Oil distributor, Dwelly Oil Company in Bakersfield. That would be 1942, and the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor, and we had blackouts. All we had, the windows were all blacked out, and Dad was a civil defense. I forget what they were called. Air raid warden.
Warden, right.
Air raid warden, and he had a helmet and a thing, and I've still got that stuff today. And one of my brothers does. I remember that. Air raid sirens, and we had to go hide and whatever. And then there was the early warning net, which was a pyramid alert of passing stuff. And I wasn't very old. I was 3, 4, and 5. And I remember that very clearly. Then we moved to Visalia, I think in 1943, and there was a squadron of P-63 Black Widows there in Visalia, which is pretty much Central California. Mm-hmm. And those guys were night fighters, and they had revetments, and oh boy, every year they'd have a big military appreciation day, and they'd beat up the airfield. Tex Rankin had a flying school of steermans down in Tulare, and they'd come up and do air shows, and we'd go to air shows a lot, and bond drives. I remember I got a ride in a Jeep for a $15 savings bond, or $50, whatever it was, one of the high points of my childhood. And we used to go to the movie every Saturday, because Victory at Sea was coming to the Fox Theater, and we were getting film out of the Pacific, and maybe it was Victory at Sea, but every week we'd have a new film, and boy, we'd go and spend 10 cents for 15, whatever it was, for Dad would drag me down to the theater, and we'd watch the Victory at Sea, and that was really awesome, cool. Man. Oh yeah, so I'm pumped. I'm ready, man. That's going to be me one day. And then, when I'm 14 years old, that'd be 1950-51, just the start of the Korean War. My next door neighbor came by with a flight of F-86s, Sabre jets, out of probably what's George Air Force Base down in Victorville. And we knew he was coming. Flight of 4 F-86 Sabre jets. And so we're out there waiting for him, and he was bang on his ETA. And I said, oh man, look at that. That's what I'm gonna do. One day that's me. And I never lost that. I never lost that. My first fighter was the F-86.
Oh, is that right?
D, the L, the interceptor version. That would be 1960. And I was one of the last classes, F-86, and then went from there straight to a squadron of F-106 Delta Darts. So I went from firing 24 2.75 folding fin aircraft rockets to four Hughes Falcons and a nuclear armed genie rocket as a second lieutenant. So there you have it.
The desire to fly was always there, but your exposure to flying obviously is another big part of that, and your family's enthusiasm for it as well.
It was unbroken, for all of us.
Well, to be able to fly, you're going to have to be a decent student. Tell me about schooling. Where did you go to school, and how well did you do in school?
I went to Denver University, studied mechanical engineering, mm-hmm. and I didn't do particularly well. I was in ROTC, and we're flying on weekends. We'd fly the C-47 out of Buckley Field at the time. There was an Air Force base right smack in the middle of Denver. It's gone today. But the Air Force Academy guys were there at, the class of 59 was right there at Buckley, mm-hmm. the very first class. And their instructors, they had F-86s, they had T-33s, and they had B-25s that the instructors were flying to stay current. So we had access to all that, so that was unbroken. And I was there 2 years.
When did you get to Denver? When did you start school there?
That would be 56, let's see. September of, let's see, 55, 56, 57, and I was there 2 years and a bit, and our ROTC unit, I was commander of the Lafayette Escadrille and everything, and I was having a wonderful time. We were marching and being soldiers and airmen and having a lot of fun. And that ROTC detachment closed down. They weren't doing particularly well. That broke my heart. So I quit, and I was struggling in engineering, thermodynamics. I never ever learned anything right away. It was always a struggle. But once I learn it, I've got it. But I had to work hard at it. I really had to work hard at it. So I thought, geez, this flying is a lot more fun than going to school. So I went off, was an aviation cadet, 3 months at Lackland. Half the guys washed out, and then 6 months to Bartow Air Base, Florida, in primary, flew the T-34 and then the T-37. 6 months, then off to Greenville, Mississippi for 6 months, flew the T-33, graduated there, and then went to Perrin Air Force Base, Texas for the F-86, and then from there in 60, to Kinchelow Air Force Base, Michigan, mm-hmm. right where the Sioux Locks are. And then we had 24 F-106s and 24 pilots. So I got my own airplane right away, number 072, and I was a happy camper. We were up north. Our stop points, our strategic orbit points, were up over the Hudson Bay, where the James Bay meets the Hudson Bay, waiting for the Russians to come across the North Pole. And we were to protect the Fort Worth complex. We had a lot of fighter squadrons back then. They were everywhere. Selfridge had two, there in Detroit, had two F-106 squadrons, but we were the first team. We were way up north.
Mm-hmm. Let me take you back down here to Lackland for officer training down here. Tell me about that. What did that consist of back then?
I was an aviation cadet. It was hard. We were hard way guys. We were enlisted, and already I was most of the way through an engineering degree, so I didn't have any trouble with the math or the scholastic stuff. I finished as an outstanding student all the way through, got a regular commission in Greenville, Mississippi. I got my wings, my gold bar, and a regular commission at the same time. So I had a jump on the student officers who were first lieutenants by the time they finished flight school. So it was hard. We call ourselves hard way guys. They beat on us night and day. I mean, it was terrible. Much worse than what I'm seeing certainly today in the Air Force Academy, maybe in the early days, but not today. Those guys are pretty weak by my standards. That's not a fair thing to say because they're officers and gentlemen, but they didn't get the shit beat out of them like we did.
So physically, these guys are flipping you around.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Well, tell me about that. What sort of things would, what sort of infraction would set somebody off? What kind of punishments would you receive?
Nothing physical until we got to survival school, but that was later. That was after graduation. Yeah. It was just mental.
Yeah.
It was mental. What a dumbass you are, we don't need pilots, Mr. Dwelly. We don't need pilots. You screw up and your weak ass is out of here. And guys were falling out left, right, and center. I think we graduated about half of our people in pre-flight, half again in the T-37 program, and then half more, maybe not quite that much, in the T-33 program, but they kept waiting us out.
Right.
And we were with foreign students, Pakistanis, who I dearly love, the Paks today. I one of my very best friend's brother is a Pakistani Air Force pilot. I talked to him for, 30 minutes yesterday. He calls me at least twice a month, and we talk politics. They love politics. He plays golf with his general buddies and drinks tea, and I meet with him occasionally, which is marvelous, just wonderful. When he comes to Canada, I go up there and am treated like a king. Mm-hmm. It's I want to go to Pakistan. As strange as that sounds, they can protect me. He has seven brothers, five of which were flag officers, Navy and Army and Air Force. This was Aftab Alam Khan. He was a fighter pilot. He graduated with me. I went to F-86s at Perrin Air Defense. He went to F-86s in Arizona. Luke, he graduated top of the class, and he got the Top Gun Award in F-86Hs. All of his instructors were Korean War aces. So he goes off to Pakistan and he flew F-86s during two of the wars, and then the F-104. He flew F-86s during the first Pak-Indian War, and then the F-104 during the second one. And he shot down an Indian Mystère, like a French Mirage, a Mystère, in a low altitude turning fight in an F-104. Now figure that out. That's pretty weird. Like my youngest brother being a draft dodger, you know. Things jump right out in front of you now and then, and you just got to deal with it, okay? So, but it was really tough. You know, you start as fourth class, one stripe, and then you're third class, two stripes, and then second class, three stripes, and then your first class, you have four stripes. Man, now you're beating up on the other three classes. Okay, boom, now you go to basic flight school. You start with one stripe again. Okay, it starts, and all the shit happens again. It starts all over.
Well, take me through this. What is the progression from where do you go to where do you go, and what kind of planes are you training on?
Well, in Florida, it was a contract school in Lakeland, Florida, Bartow Air Base. The instructors were all very experienced civilians, and not military retreads as far as I know, although I do know it was an open secret in 59 that our instructors were running guns. They had a war surplus B-25, and at night they were running guns down into Cuba, down into
probably
was Castro to overthrow Batista. It was an open secret, and I thought, geez, I'd like to maybe go along with them, but I think I don't know enough about that. One thing I developed over the years, I'm a master at evaluating threat, okay? So I threw that one away right at the beginning. But later on, I was to get involved in that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, where I flew with a solo, with a fully armed nuclear rocket. And then later on in NORAD, simulating the Cuban threat against the NORAD system. I was the chief of live exercise branch for NORAD for a number of years. And then ultimately I got to go to, Peggy and I went to Havana for a week early on. That's been, five or six years ago. Mm. Early on, it was hard to do. Cost a lot of money, but you can do it, work through a swindle. We were taking drugs to Cuba, as it were, legally, and that's, you know, aspirin and vitamins and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And you know, it was a wonderful trip. So I got to close that whole loop.
Well, that's kind of nice, yeah.
Which was fun. There's a book, by the way, called 60 Seconds to Midnight, which goes over the whole Cuban thing, and I was involved in every part of it. And I can't fault anything I see in that book.
Well, let me ask you that. We're jumping ahead here a little bit, but that's fine. While we're on the topic, where were you, what were your responsibilities when this whole thing kicked off? We're looking at, you know, October 1962.
22nd.
Yeah. Tell me about this from your perspective. When did it start for you? What are you doing? What are you seeing? What are your responsibilities?
I'd been combat ready, even as a second lieutenant, for a year because I was an aviation cadet. I'd not been promoted yet to first lieutenant. And we were on alert. We were good up there. We were good. There's no APC, area positive control. You could fly above 18,000 feet. You can't do that today except being on an instrument flight plan. But, you know, it's... anything goes. We're running intercepts on airliners. You know, nobody thought anything about that. We were damn good. And running high-speed supersonic intercepts. I had my own full-pressure suit. We all had moon suits. We trained with the astronauts down in Florida. Ours were orange, and theirs were white, you know, reflecting. We wanted to be rescued out over the tundra up in Canada or wherever, but we have to have a full pressure suit to fly above 50,000 feet. Okay, so boom, we were ready. We'd been flying with hot missiles for 2 weeks prior to the president blowing the whistle for us, and you don't run intercepts on airliners without missiles, by the way. So we were content with running intercepts on each other. We had target aircraft and high altitude. We were good. Man, we were running against Mach 2 targets, and I'm the second lieutenant. Every time somebody needed a Mach 2 target at 65,000 feet, second lieutenant Dwelly, get your moon suit on, let's go, you're on the schedule. So yeah, the guys didn't like to do that. Unless they had to, but I did a lot of moonsuit sorties, and we all had to do it if that was our task or whatever, or we were going to go to snap up really high. A snap up is a pitch up to go after a very high altitude target. And we had long wing B-57s, Canberras, that were way, way, way up there with jammers against the B-58 Hustlers were tough. The worst were the SR-71s out of Beale. Subsequently, I flew out of Merced in my second tour, flying intercepts against the SR-71. Forget it. Forget it, man. They were bulletproof. Okay, it's now October the 22nd, 1962. I'm on alert. I'm in the alert barn, and we'd been nuke-loaded for 2 or 3 days because we knew something was coming. So we loaded up the nuclear weapon in addition to the two infrared missiles and the two heat-seeker missiles that we already had on our airplanes. All the Hangar Queens were out and put back together. Maintenance did an outstanding job, and we had all 24 of our F-106 interceptors on the line. Two of them were B models with two seats, but we didn't have pilots in the back seat, so they flew all of those a single seat. I had my own airplane, 072, which was the best airplane on the ramp because I took good care of it and I watched it all the time, so I was ready to go. And we're sitting upstairs. It was just after lunch, as I recall. And we didn't have moon suits on or anything like that, but we did have our boots on in the day, and we had a harness on because those of us in the alert barn were on 5 minute hot five. We had five from sound asleep. We had to be airborne, wheels in the well, in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you slept even in your harness, and then the parachute, all that stuff is in the airplane. So you get in when you're starting the engine. The crew chief hooks you up, and just before he gets sucked into the thing, he goes down, and you close the canopy, spooled up, pull the power, and then you go. Okay, so the klaxon goes off, and there's nothing like a klaxon. Wah! 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 Like that. Oh, shit. And the word came over, flush, flush, flush. What that means is you're a ballistic missile target, and you have 15 minutes to impact. Hmm. That's what a flush means. Flush means we disperse to your pre-assigned dispersal base. Ours was an Air National Guard base in Alpena, Michigan, called Phelps Collins. There was nothing there, no tower, no armament, no security. And then pretty soon we had 24 nuke-loaded airplanes, and we were our own security. We all carried sidearms, and there were tugs. So we got some maintenance guys there who took a tug into town to bring us back pizzas, and then here comes the security police. So pretty soon we had a deal, and then we had chow. But we're packing our parachutes with our drag chute. Weather was terrible. Weather was terrible. We had three broken arrows that night. A broken arrow is an accident with a nuclear weapon. Okay, not in my squadron, but there were through the air defense network. We put three F-106s out into the boondocks, two off the side of the runway and one off the end. Gear up, and hurts the airplane bad. And now you got an armed nuclear weapon sitting in the dirt. I don't know that they're armed. Back to the klaxon. Klaxon goes off. We're upstairs in this forebay. You know, the alert barn, the clamshell doors open up front and back. So the crew chief, he runs, opens up the doors, gets the power unit going, and we run and slide down the fireman's pole. We get to the bottom, and Don Tharp, right behind me, I said, "Don, what about the bean?" We called the nuclear rocket the bean. He said, "Tom, it looks like we're going to war. Pull the pin." I pulled the pin out of the bottom of that weapon, closed the missile bay doors, got in the cockpit, and as soon as I sat down, I went outboard, hit ignition, and the engine starts to spool up. Crew chief hooks up my seat belt, he's hooking my parachute up, and I got the, hands me the straps, I put it through, hook that up, and then he gets back, he's hanging into the cockpit, and that giant air scoop is right here, and now we're spooling up that big engine, and I was first one off. Nobody ever beat me off. I was always more prepared, and I really could do little things to be the first one off. I think some of the guys took off on the taxiway too, but see, we were a prime target because we had 15 B-52Hs there, and those guys had 10 megaton weapons.
Yeah.
And the case, yeah, where did everybody go? Yeah, sunburst, and 15 KC-135. So the deal was that the interceptors got off first, as best we could, And then the tankers had to wait till the bombers were off. Okay, then they finally went. And I armed my weapon, Don armed his. I don't know that anybody else ever did. We never talked about that. We never, ever, to this day, I don't know. I'm afraid to ask.
There wasn't some sort of general order telling you guys, all right, pull the pin.
The only time you can do that is if you're going to war.
Yeah.
No, no, you don't fly a single-seat airplane. See, a nuclear weapon has to be under two-man control. Well, in a single-seat fighter, okay, you're the crew chief, all right? You're my number one guy. See you later, pal. I'm out of here. Have a nice life. I'll see you on the other side. God knows what's going to happen. Now, I do remember that not thinking about my family, my wife. I was newly married. I had a baby girl, Christine, and I never thought about them. I was just totally focused on the job. I mean, that's what this aviation cadet program does for you. It drills into that you're a badass guy, and we're essentially reprogrammed. Okay, brainwashed or whatever, but that's what we were. When you do what we did and with no obvious signs of remorse, you know, pretty soon you get a big shell built around you, and that probably was responsible for the failure of my first marriage after 14 years. But, you know, I'm so programmed to take that hill, as Ollie North would say, you know, damn the torpedoes, whatever. I thought later, I said, geez, I never even thought about Kay and Christine, you know, which is a little embarrassing, but that tells you how we were programmed. And bam, there's also a Nike Hercules site right there in town, air defense missile site. So we were a prime target. So we had to get the hell out of Dodge. We truly thought when they said flush, that means ballistic missiles are airborne from Russia.
Frightening.
Totally frightening. I got 270 missions in Vietnam in 65. It was nasty stuff. Night, weather, in the mountains, heavy artillery flying everywhere, flares, and what scared me the worst was that night. Yeah, the other stuff, you know, it's like, you know, you saw the movie Top Gun. Okay, when you do that two or three times a day, it gets pretty routine. But we're living out on the edge. You can live out on the edge, but you can't ever make any mistakes. Not ever, okay? And my wife, Peggy, who was an air racer, she says, if you're not living out on the edge, you're using up too much space. Okay, so that's how I raise my kids, and that's how I teach anybody that'll listen, and that's how I run my life, and we have the most fun. But it's fun living out on the edge, but you can't ever make any mistakes. Trust me, I know that.
Yeah. All right, so you're loaded up. You're ready to go. Crew chief says goodbye. Pick it up from there.
I said goodbye to him. there was nothing left on that base. The wing commander is saying, what the hell is going on? You know, both the SAC wing, it was Air Defense Base. SAC was a tenant. And both wing commanders are thinking, what in the hell just happened? Because nobody had any warning. Nobody had any warning. President Kennedy was just about to get nose to nose with Khrushchev. Okay, and that happened right after that, within 4 days. And he said, that's when he went over the air. He said, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to say this about that. Firstly, we have a very distinct problem. Yeah, you know how he did. And as he started that, boom, they pulled the trigger on us and got us the dispersal. See, because he said we're going to war against Cuba. Okay, we're going to take the top 6 feet off of that island, and the TAC guys, the tactical, the TAC hired killers, they were set to do that too. And the problem was, did we know where all of those nuclear weapons were over there? Turns out we didn't. We knew where the four ballistic missile sites were. What we didn't know until later in that book, 60 Minutes to Midnight, was that they had nuclear frogs or something, free rocket overground, you know, the Soviet tactical ground-to-ground missiles aimed at Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, and they can't reach even Key West with those, as I recall. But I mean, it was a big fright. I mean, it was really a scary time, and nothing like it, even in combat. I had the hell scared out of me a number of times in combat, but. You know, I'm not a very religious person. I'm a scientist of sorts. My degree's in engineering and mathematics. I went back later to finish up my degree, and I got straight A's, by the way, when I could focus and fly when I had to, not when I wanted to. And it was... It was a whole different ball game at that point. I lost my train of thought there momentarily.
No, that's okay. It's probably a good time for us to stop right now, Tom, as bad as I hate to.